Spotlight.
Doing us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Last week, Peru's President Pedro Castillo was removed from office. His charge, quote, rebellion, which came after he announced that he would shut down Congress. Enter Castillo's Vice President Dina Boluarte, who was sworn in as the new president, becoming the first female head of state in Peru's history. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at what has happened in Peru and whether the U.S., who has shown support for the coup and the new president, had any role in it. First, let me introduce our guests for this edition of The Spotlight. Arnold August joins us. He's an author and journalist from Montreal. Also joining us is Libra Sankar, who's a contributor at the Troika Collective, joining us from Miami.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. Libra Sankar, I'll start with you. If you can please tell us, in so many words, what has happened in Peru? What did Pedro Castillo do to be dealt the harsh hand that he has been dealt with at this point?
So what we have happening in Peru is not anything new to the history. Peruvian politics have unfortunately developed into what is happening today. So what happens? Pedro Castillo represents the indigenous community. He comes from a working class background. And he represents a move towards a Peru that acknowledges the role of working class people, of indigenous people. And so he poses a threat to the working class, or he poses a threat to the far right people that come from like Fujimori and the Fujimoristas. He also was pushing for a new constitution, which is one of the platforms that he ran on and got high approval for. And so Pedro Castillo represents what the far right fears, which is Peru moving towards a working class politic that benefits the working class people of Peru and the indigenous people of Peru. And this is a very scary thing, which is why a coup has been orchestrated. What Pedro Castillo was pushing for in dissolving Congress is nothing new. In fact, the president prior to him did it, and many other presidents have done it. It's part of their constitution that a president can dissolve Congress if they feel they're not able to move forward. And so Pedro Castillo, unfortunately, is part of a larger plan to continue destabilizing Peru so that U.S. corporations and people like the U.S. ambassador can continue to take advantage of the of Peru as a mineral-rich country and a country that is full of working-class people.
Okay, very good. We're going to get to some of those points a little later, but first, trying to understand how Peru has unraveled at the speed that it has, Arnold August. And our guests there mentioned something that is very key in this, and that is the fact that you know, this is not anything new, what Pedro Castillo did, which was in essence, to be more concrete here, it was Article 134 that is something that he enacted, which was only going to be a temporary closure from what we understand, in which the president said new congressional elections would then be held as soon as possible. So are we to take the fact that what was then done to him was part of, as our guest there mentioned, of a bigger plan to oust him?
Yes, of course. I'm quite sure right after he got elected, I'm sure that the United States and their allies in Europe and Canada started to go into action in order to plan what we call lawfare, that is using juridical or so-called legal means to overthrow the elected president. And, you know, we just discussed, you know, the question of the United States' role. I mean, the day before his arrest and the coup took place, the day before, the American embassy in Peru actually met with the opposition. So they are directly involved in that. And I think that the fact that he dissolved the Congress, I perfectly believe it is a correct decision, while some, you know, middle of the roaders are saying, well, we oppose what happened to him, but the fact that he dissolved the Congress was not right. It was right, because right now, who has the last word on this? It should be the people in the streets. And the people in the streets in Peru right now are calling for a constituent assembly. That is to replace that Congress. So that decision was right, I think, legally, morally, and also historically, because it opens up a new path for the people in the street. And we saw, when we discuss these type of governments before at Press TV, I always presented the position that we cannot, you know, whether it's the left, part of the left tide or not, I always was always of the opinion we cannot concentrate on the personalities who won elections, for example, Boric in Chile, and now Castillo in Peru. What we have to look at is the larger picture. Where did Castillo come from? He came from a mass movement of indigenous workers. He himself is a teacher. And that what brought him into power. And that is why on the ground now, that you were talking about the left, the pink tide. The pink tide in Peru is happening right now.
Indeed. Well, tell us your reaction, if you can, Libra Sankara, to the a move that the VP, Dina Boluarte, made and then became the president, where she accused the president of, I don't want to call him the former president, but it appears that way for now, Castillo, of a coup attempt. And then basically it just happened a few hours later from what we understand, where she became the president. She was sworn in. I mean, why would she be the one chosen for this, do you think? And at this point, obviously, we're seeing the backlash on the streets. So is that a miscalculation on the part of the grand scheme of things?
I think what we have is betrayal. The ambassador of the U.S. met with Dina Boluarte, the so-called president of Peru. And given the trajectory of Peruvian politics, it's also highly unlikely that she herself is going to last until the 2026 elections. And again, Pedro Castillo is the only democratically elected president. The people did not elect Dina Boluarte to lead them. And I think this speaks to the move and the direction that Peru was trying to go into. The comrade just spoke about pink tide. And I think what we see happening in Latin America right now is the U.S. trying to impose unipolarity. And we see pink tide 2.0 coup and coup attempts. This is happening in Peru. They're using lawfare in Argentina, and they're trying to do another coup in Bolivia. And all these happen to be countries that are moving further to the left. So Dina Boluarte is just a pawn in the larger grand scheme of the U.S. trying to maintain its exploitative relationship to countries like Peru, that if they are to develop for the Peruvian masses of people, the indigenous Peruvians, the working class Peruvians, that Peru could in fact stand on its own two feet and not have to be dependent on the U.S. In this very parasitic exploitative relationship. And Europe is just as guilty in this as well. Europe is guilty because they're playing more of the corporate side of things. Their corporations, the mining, are all corporations that are in Europe, and as well as the U.S. It's kind of like a joint venture.
So many people have referred to the EU being a vassal state of the U.S. But let's look into the situation more with the U.S. interference, Arnold August, as both of you have indicated that that occurred. Now, Arnold August, you said that just a day earlier, before this went down, you had the U.S. ambassador meet with the opposition. We also understand that a day before, this U.S. ambassador, who is a former CIA agent, also met with, the defense minister, from what we understand, a retired brigadier general, which then we understand he ordered the military to turn against Castillo. So this is not something that has happened in a matter of just 24, 48 hours. As both of you have indicated, in a sense, this is a scheme, a plan that the U.S., in conjunction with different players within Peru's political apparatus, had planned before. Am I correct to look at it that way?
Yes, I think that's absolutely correct. And you and our guest just mentioned the United States and other actors such as Europe. Allow me to point out to another actor that is much more vigorous in support of the coup than the Europeans, and that is Canada. You know, Canada is right from the start took the following position, saying they issued a one-sentence statement saying Canada would like to express its deep concern over Castillo's attempt to dissolve Congress and establish a government of exception in Peru. Such destabilizing actions risk jeopardizing Peru's adherence to democracy. And if that is not enough, another statement from Canada came out the day later. Canada calls for calm and invites all actors. That's a very famous line from Canada, all actors. When the revolt was taking place in Chile a couple of years ago, and it was obvious the use of the army and the Carabineros in actually killing and maiming people, they always call for all actors to avoid tensions and all that. Now, I cannot help myself to make the comparison. While the Trudeau government jumps right from start one, run from game one, the first day, in opposing the demonstrations of millions of people in Peru, indigenous workers, against the coup. In Iran, they support the U.S.-led riots that are taking place in Iran. So I think it's important for people to really have a good grasp of the dirty role that Canada plays through Justin Trudeau as the most faithful ally of U.S. imperialism, not only in Latin America, but internationally.
Sure. Well, they have played destructive roles when we go through the different actions that have been executed, with the U.S. being in the lead in many of them. But before we get to that, let's look at some of the reactions, Libre Sankara, of Latin American leaders, because you have many of the governments. At last count, there were seven of them, where you have Mexico, Argentina, Bolivia, Colombia, Honduras, Venezuela, Cuba, and some other nations at this point, who have criticized and refused to recognize Peru's unelected coup regime, as they have called it. Is that going to make a difference in the fate of Peru and where it's headed when you have this opposition of this magnitude?
I think what it symbolizes is a shift towards multipolarity, a shift away from U.S. Imperialism and its role in Latin America in general. I think things like this will become more frequent. I don't know that it will have tangible presence in Peru itself. I think the Peruvian people, the ronderos that come from these indigenous communities that helped to have this historical victory to elect Pedro Castillo as president, I think between them and Peru Libre and other left factions in Peru will ultimately play the most important roles. But I think what these statements help do is to to help the Peruvian people understand that they have the solidarity of other countries. I don't know that these countries are going to send any real firm resources to help help Peruvians fight against this. But I also see countries like Mexico trying to talk with the government to offer Pedro Castillo asylum. In fact, when he realized what was happening, he tried to go to the Mexican embassy, and he was barred from doing that by his security detail, and shortly after he was detained. And so we have to be very vigilant of what's going to continue to happen. Unfortunately, more Peruvians are going to be killed because they democratically elected Pedro Castillo. They want him in office. They are going out into the streets, but this is being met by the far right that has no problem killing people, that has no problem harming its own citizens to maintain its own greedy benefit that these far right Fujimorista type of people hope to continue. They want to continue being in positions of power and exploiting their own people and getting business deals. And so the seven countries, and I'm sure there will be more to follow, are simply showing their solidarity with the working class people. Hopefully that shows up in tangible ways. But as in the foreseeable future, it doesn't look like they're going to send any material things. This is symbolic, and it's helpful to build morale, but that's about it.
Okay, well, Arnold August, our guest, also mentioned the pink tide. And we've seen what has happened in the past couple of years in terms of the political landscape that is characterized by the term pink tide, where you have these left-wing presidents pretty much come into power because they are the ones that actually represent the true people out in the broad economy and society of the different countries that they represent. I mean, one of the most, prolific ones would be the Brazilian President Lula da Silva that came out in some sense, and him winning the presidency was very was an eye-opener, I would guess, from the U.S. perspective, because he made one announcement, and that was how he wants there to be a move away from the dollar. He wants the local economies of each country to deal in their national currencies. Are we looking at this to have ticked off the U.S., this new wave of left-wing presidents, as they say, and therefore they are now counter-reacting to that?
Yes, I would say so. I just add, both of you rightly mentioned all of the presidents and leaders of the Latin American countries that took a firm stand publicly in support of Castillo. I would add one other book that just came out, I think, yesterday, and that is ALBA, which includes many countries, including in the small Caribbean island. In terms of the current situation, I think aside from what happened to Cristina Kirchner a couple of weeks ago, this attempt here is the first attempt of a coup since the election of Lula in Brazil. You know, I think that is going to make a big difference. Brazil, of course, as everyone knows, it's a major player in Latin America, and through BRICS, it has important ties with other important countries such as China, India, South Africa, and Russia. And the way China is now increasingly making its presence felt on the international scale with regards to other countries, for example, just a few days ago, making a clear statement in support of the right of Palestine to its own state with its capital in East Jerusalem. The United States might have some surprises, as not only the countries in Latin America that perhaps feel more confident, more bold since the election of Brazil, but even internationally, this may build up further, and it may be a very hard situation for the United States and its allies to face while Castillo is in prison, and everyone is against that in Peru and many countries of the world, not only in Latin America.
Okay. The fact that you came out right away pretty much, Libra Sankar, and talked about how you have Castillo that represents the indigenous population there in Peru, and the fact that he is the one that was able to edge out in the vote because he had the common people be on his side. Tell us the way that this has backfired for the ones that were in control of the major industries and how they felt threatened. And perhaps given the fact that they have connections, and I'm just making the connection here, and whether it's accurate or not, it's up for you to tell us. And that these, for example, we know that Castillo brought in a lot of new ministers. And I'm guessing just that fact itself might have threatened the livelihoods of some of these people who, I don't know if I want to call them oligarchs or not, but, you know, the ones that were in power in different sectors and fields of the economy. And therefore, they obviously sided with the motion to try to oust Castillo. And that's where the U.S. connection also comes in, because you have Peru that has a lot of important natural resources, gold being the number one, from what I understand, natural resource of Peru. Is that a correct reading into this?
Yeah, that is an accurate reading. And in fact, I mean, Peru since the colonial times has been taken advantage of by foreign interests. And so what Castillo represents is indigenous working class, right? Like, this is somebody that when they were giving speeches, they spoke in the indigenous language, which brought a lot of the elected officials to anger, because their status quo is to speak Spanish, to kind of take on this more, it's not educated to speak like that, and this demonization of indigenous people in a country that's mostly indigenous, they just until Pedro Castillo were not in positions of power. They weren't being appointed. Their perspectives were not being brought into policies. Their perspectives were not being brought into the proposed new constitution, which is something that has also been happening during the peak tide. A lot of these left governments have been rewriting their constitutions or codifying new laws. For example, Cuba just passed its family codes, and Chile, unfortunately, didn't vote, but they were looking to rewrite their own constitution. And so Pedro Castillo also represents and came from the Peru Libre Party, which, he appointed a Marxist-Leninist in his cabinet, which unfortunately the individual had to step down because shortly after being put into his position, he got death threats. And this just shows how status quo the career politicians want to keep Peru. Again, Peru, with such rich economy and such access to resources, has been a country that has been overexploited and underdeveloped. And this works to the benefit of these career politicians and to foreign interests instead of the interests of Peruvians. And so Pedro Castillo represented and still represents a move towards a new type of Peru, a Peru that is moving left and closer to a Peru for Peruvians themselves. And so this scares people that don't want that to be the reality because it doesn't benefit their pockets. Okay. And so that's why millions of Peruvians are out in the streets protecting and asking for his release.
Thank you for that. Arnold August, author and journalist from Montreal, a pleasure. And Libra Sankara, thank you. Contributor at the Troika Collective from Miami. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Miko Batawe and the team, it's goodbye.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, family pathology and theological doubts. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the topic of family pathology and the theological doubts in the Islamic lifestyle. We know that in order to have an Islamic lifestyle, we must have a firm knowledge of Islam, because you know, when we want to follow something, we must know about it. We must have the knowledge, the enough knowledge about that thing. One of the issues that we see in today's family life, when we see that the people are having the issues in their family life or the family system is becoming weak, it is because that the people are not well aware of their religion. They are not aware of the theological terms or, you know, the things that are said, and therefore their beliefs become weak. So this is because when they have theological doubts in their mind and they don't solve it, and later when they have kids and they cannot explain it to their kids, we see that unfortunately some families face the difficulties. Some families, their kids face many difficulties. For example, you know, one of the theological doubts can be the religious pluralism. If the religious pluralism, the concept is not clear for the people who are the Muslims, that what does religious pluralism means, then obviously the kids, the families, they become secular. And that's why we see in Islam Muslims becoming secular because of this ideology. Why? Because they never could solve these issues. For example, another example can be the doubt about the justice. When they do not know that Allah is just and what does it mean, then obviously they will have these issues in their life. Therefore, it is necessary to get the knowledge, the true knowledge, and to be firm in following the Islam, inshallah. Welcome back. You're listening to A2Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the topic of the family pathology and theological doubts in the Islamic lifestyle. We said that when the family members, when the parents, the guardians, they do not have the enough knowledge about the Islam, then obviously the issues comes in the family. For example, the parents, obviously, they have learned something. They were believing in a God. They were believing that the God is just, but they don't know how to explain it. They do not have the reasons. They never read about it. And it is necessary to read about your beliefs because Quran is the book of guidance. Since our parents, the people, they never read the Quran, they never read the whole Quran in order to know the proofs or reasons that why we believe in God, why we believe in the hereafter, why we believe in the prophets, what was the characteristics of the prophets. When our kids go to the schools and they have doubts or the questions about the creation of the man, for example, they go to the school, they learn the Darwinism, they learn about the Big Bang Theory, and we as a parent, because we never read the Quran, because we never went through these questions, we believe because of our parents and we don't know it from the actual source, the knowledge, the source of knowledge. Therefore, we cannot answer. And there we see that the relation between the kids and the parents, it becomes weaker. So there is a dispute amongst them. There is always the father is, you know, they see that maybe like their father is forcing them to go to the mosque. And it looks like something which is forcefully being done to them. And the main reason is that because our families have not gained enough knowledge about these issues, that's why these things are happening. Therefore, if we want to have a good Islamic lifestyle, a pure Islamic lifestyle, we must go after the knowledge. We must learn these things so that tomorrow we can explain the things truly and easily to our kids, inshallah. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thanks for listening to A2Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/en/call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
The Taliban officials on Tuesday ordered a nationwide ban on university education for Afghan women. Earlier, a letter made public by the spokesman for the Ministry of Higher Education, Ziaullah Hashimi, outlining that the measure would take effect immediately in private and public universities. Today, the Taliban forces barred women from entering Kabul University.
This piece of news was really disappointing. Last night, when I was told that the Taliban have ordered girls to be excluded from universities, I couldn't eat or sleep. After so many efforts and attending several classes in hope of making a bright future, they at once ruined everything. This order is very painful and unacceptable. It has to be reversed.
This was very shocking. Nowadays, we've been sitting our final test. Today, despite knowing that they wouldn't let us in, I rushed to the university. This is very difficult for an Afghan girl to comprehend the weight of being barred from getting education. So far, I've been worrying for my sisters who are banned from schools, and from now on, I should be concerned about my future too.
Afghan experts warn that the new order will have a devastating impact on the future of women as well as the entire Afghan nation. They urge the Taliban authorities to stop rolling back Afghan women's rights.
It is a catastrophic decision to ban women from universities. This can also be seen as a terrifying shock for Afghan society, especially the youth and women. It is so bitter and concerning. Previously, the explosion hit our girl students in tuition centers, but this devastating order is targeting the progress of a whole nation. The effects and consequences of this illogical order are unfortunate and irreparable in different arenas.
And it's difficult to imagine how a country can...
In addition to oppositions from inside Afghanistan, the United Nations and several countries have condemned the order. They have signaled that the Taliban administration won't get recognition until they equally observe the human rights of all Afghans. After taking power, the Taliban promised a softer role and upholding women's rights. But today, many here say that the Taliban have been failing to abide by their promises. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Capital dwellers here in Tehran's Tajrish Bazaar, jam-packed shopping centers to buy last-minute items and prepare for the ancient festival of Yalda night. The occasion is marked with a variety of long-held traditions, which continue until dawn.
We have came here to buy some sweets and some cake so we could celebrate Yalda tonight. You know, the Western people have Christmas and we have Yalda. I think it's really beautiful and the families are gathering together. It's really Iranian culture.
Besides nuts and sweets, watermelon and pomegranates are also on top of the shopping list, as they are integral to a perfect Yalda gathering. This means the demand for these items multiply, and their prices skyrocket on this night.
On Yalda, we gather in the house of the elder members of the family, and of course, pomegranates and watermelons and pistachios have to be there. Their prices get higher on Yalda, but we have no other choice but to buy them.
Yalda is the last night of the fall and the longest night of the year in the Northern Hemisphere. As is the custom in Iran, families get together to cheer and chatter, eat and drink, and read poems until dawn.
Yalda reunites families and promotes kindness. When all family members and relatives sit together, it helps sort out old grievances and open a new chapter in the relationships.
Yalda means birth in Persian. In ancient mythology, it is believed that the Persian god of light and truth was born in the morning after the longest night of the year to rid the world of darkness and wash away unpleasant experiences. The tradition is marked in Iran and across the Persian-speaking communities in several other countries, including Tajikistan and Afghanistan. Last month, Yalda night was officially registered by UNESCO as a cultural heritage in Iran and Afghanistan, a major step toward immortalizing this long-standing tradition, which aims to warm the hearts of Iranians on the coldest night of the year. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Japan has slowly developed the scope and scale of its military forces since its defeat in World War II. Despite its pacifist constitution, Prime Minister Fumio Kishida Friday announced a major shift in its post-war self-defense principle.
When considering strengthening our defense capabilities this time, we will assume various situations and consider whether the current capabilities of self-defense forces can deter threats to Japan based on the capabilities of our opponents and new ways of fighting.
Outside the Japanese embassy in Seoul, South Korea, activists protested against Japan's new military plans. Japan ruled over Korea for much of the first half of the 20th century. Civic leaders argue Japan's force buildup, to include various U.S. missiles and counter-strike strategy, can enable its military to again become offensive in nature.
The Japanese government's so-called counterattack capability actually involves preemptively striking enemy bases in North Korea, China, and Russia with missiles. As a result, Japan's principle of self-defense is completely broken, and the peace constitution, its minimum responsibility as a war criminal state, remained empty.
Japan suggests it's responding to increasing threats from North Korea and China.
Over the next 5 years, Japan plans to double its military spending from 1% to 2% of GDP. And much of that, more than $300 billion, is earmarked to be spent in America's military-industrial complex.
Japan's new military budget comes just as the U.S. increases its annual military spending to $858 billion. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Iran's nuclear chief announced this week that the capacity of uranium enrichment in the country is now twice as high as the total volume produced since the onset of the nuclear industry in Iran. He made the remarks in an exhibition showcasing Iran's latest achievements in the nuclear sector.
We aim to generate 20% of the country's electricity from nuclear energy and the use of radiation technology.
This is one of the achievements Iran has publicized in recent days, which is viewed as a response to what Tehran describes as the West dilly-dallying on the revival of the 2015 deal. The pact has been in limbo since the U.S. walked out of it in 2018 and reinstated sanctions on Iran.
The Americans claim that the Vienna talks are no longer a priority for them amid the unrest in Iran. First of all, they have a role in engineering the riots. Secondly, they do want to resume the negotiations, but they are trying to use the unrest as a bargaining chip in the talks.
In October this year, Iran deployed more advanced centrifuges at its three enrichment facilities, increasing their total number to 4,000. The Atomic Energy Organization of Iran announced this week that it's now enriching uranium at a historic 60% rate using the new advanced centrifuges.
As hopes for the revival of the 2015 deal dwindle, Iran says it reserves its right to boost its nuclear energy program, which it says is clearly stipulated in the accord. The AEOI says it will not wait for the resumption of the Vienna talks and will continue to expand its nuclear activities for peaceful purposes. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
The Saudi coalition has seized another fuel ship bound for Yemen, keeping it from reaching the port of Hodeidah to unload the much-needed fuel. Military officials based in Sana'a confirmed that they have not ruled out the military option against the Saudi coalition in order to prevent what they call acts of piracy in the Red Sea.
I can confidently say that in the near future or in the days ahead, we will all witness an escalation of military operations, and perhaps we are going to see a one-of-a-kind military operation that will target the vessels in the Red Sea that are pirating Yemeni fuel ships which have received the necessary permits from the United Nations. The Yemeni army could also target the oil industry in both Saudi Arabia and the UAE. I can certainly assure you that the status quo is going to change, as military officials' strategic patience is wearing thin.
According to the spokesperson for the Yemeni petroleum company, Isam al-Mutawakkil, all Yemeni fuel ships are forced to sail on a path crossing near the Saudi Arabian coastal area of Jazan, where an American base is believed to be operating.
All Yemeni fuel ships bound for Yemen have been seized and fallen victim to these acts of piracy near the Saudi coastal area of Jizan, where they are searched under American supervision. This is happening despite the fact that they are already being inspected by Djibouti. Therefore, we should hold accountable the Saudi and American coalition along with the United Nations, which is allowing these acts of piracy that are causing great harm to the Yemeni people.
Yemeni military and political personnel have expressed that a peaceful solution will be impossible if the humanitarian situation continues to deteriorate due to a limited supply of fuel and diesel. Tensions are also on the rise in the strategic province of Hodeidah, where coalition forces are reportedly building up.
If there is not going to be a peaceful or political solution, then perhaps the solution is going to come through the barrel of our rifles in order to stop these aggressor nations which are taking orders from their American and Zionist masters.
As 2022 draws to an end, so do all efforts for a peaceful solution. However, as the humanitarian situation continues to grow worse by the day in Yemen, the military option could be the only option left on the table.
The Yemeni government based in the capital Sana'a has proved that it has the military capability to hit long-range targets in land and at sea. However, it is still keen to reach a political solution and end the conflict that has taken the lives of tens of thousands of innocent people. Yusuf Maudi, Sana'a.
About 70 officials and representatives of think tanks and research centers from 36 countries are in Tehran to attend the Tehran Dialogue Forum 2022. The initiative, dubbed Neighborhood Policy of the Islamic Republic of Iran, is the third of its kind, and this time it focuses on regional friendship and trust building.
The main message of this forum is boosting regional cooperation and dialogue. We always welcome dialogue, particularly when it comes to finding solutions to the challenges that we face.
The keynote speakers of the forum, former Iranian Foreign Minister Kamal Kharrazi, the former Prime Minister of Iraq Adel Abdel Mahdi, the Nicaraguan Foreign Minister Denis Ronaldo Moncada, and other participants reiterated the same stance, giving Iran credit for the initiative.
This is important in order to strengthen your policy in the regional dimension. Due to the new dimension in the whole world, a new world order that is much more focused on regionalism than as on the wide international arena.
Pakistan and Iran are the only two countries that are always directly affected by Afghanistan. So I think the Tehran Dialogue Forum is very important in that regard, that there has to be regional dialogue. And Iran being at the forefront of this is a welcoming development. And I think, look, it's important for the region to take ownership. And we see Iran doing that through this forum. And I think it's important, again, to discuss through dialogue to move forward towards any cooperation.
The message of the forum, however, is not limited to regional countries.
We can only really build peace
if we do it through dialogue and with the diversity of participation. So I think we are grateful for the invitation to Venezuela, and we think it's important to address this. Even though we're not from the region of Iran, we also think in regional terms. Venezuela is part of Latin America and the Caribbean. We are a zone of peace, as we decreed it in 2014, and we think that it is important for the different regions of the world to establish communication and see how we can really face common challenges.
The first and second rounds of the Tehran Dialogue Forum were held in 2019 and 2020. And as always, addressing the latest developments in West Asia will be on top of the agenda.
The discussions of the Tehran Dialogue Forum 2022 will continue in four different panels, focusing on regional security, energy security, the Ukraine crisis, and the prospects of peace in Afghanistan. Yusumi Shahmadi, Tehran.
The first Iranian-made particle accelerator. The high-tech device produces high-energy beams by accelerating electrons close to the speed of light. Developed by Iran's Nuclear Science and Technology Research Institute, the dynamitron-type accelerator was unveiled at the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran on Saturday.
We aim to generate 20% of the country's electricity from nuclear energy and the use of radiation technology. We focused on various accelerators and radiation systems, which can serve a wide range of needs in society. It's a technology that improves the health sector and can be used in food security and environmental preservation.
The Iranian accelerator will be used for food irradiation, cable and wire manufacturing, tire industries, sewage treatment, and sterilization of medical devices. The AEOI says the machine will also be employed in treating cancer patients.
The applications of this technology are numerous, but compared to developed countries, we have stepped into the field of particle accelerators about 50 years later. In fact, we have possessed this technology for a long time, but it was limited to research purposes.
Particle accelerators were first invented in the 1960s to study high-energy particle collisions, but it didn't take scientists long to notice their byproduct, and that is an extremely bright light that can be used in investigating the structure of crystals and proteins, monitoring air pollution, studying disease mechanisms, HD imaging, and cancer radiation therapy, among other applications.
With a wide range of applications, from medicine to agriculture, the homegrown accelerator, as put by its developers, will transform different industries in Iran. Experts here say for sanctions hit Iran, building such a high-tech device is more than an achievement, but a miracle. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Afghan people have been calling for transparent and impartial investigations into crimes and wrongdoings by NATO forces on their soil. Among them, relatives of victims of the NATO war in southern Helmand province are demanding justice for the killing of 54 unarmed people by British Special Air Service troops there. The dead include children. Afghans want the murderers should be held accountable.
Helmand province witnessed deadly night raids and airstrikes by NATO forces, especially those of the UK. Besides, civilian captives were tortured and shot dead. In one case, children were thrown off military planes. I remember so many atrocities by the foreign forces in which civilians were harmed. We call for those British and American perpetrators to be tried in an impartial and transparent court. They should be brought to account and victims should receive compensation.
However, the UK government has announced the start of an inquiry into wrongdoings by its forces in Afghanistan, but some experts say only transparent probes by independent bodies can help make headway with the case. They believe investigations by foreign governments could cover up the facts about the gross violations at the hands of their forces in Afghanistan. During the two-decade US invasion, Afghanistan witnessed much disgrace by NATO troops. More and more facts are emerging regarding unlawful killings and gross violations by foreign forces on Afghan soil. The U.S. war on Afghanistan has left many Afghans in great suffering. People here are calling for accountability and justice for years of gross violation by the NATO troops. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Fans of
family members of the victims of the Itaewon tragedy and thousands of their supporters remembered those 158 mostly young people whose lives were taken in a crowd crush October 29th. Some read letters to their lost loved ones.
Last year, we made a whole bunch of snow ducks all around outside our apartment. Please come and see me in my dreams sometimes. Please come see me someday, maybe even as my future child. I love you forever, Seon.
Although tens of thousands were gathered, police did not manage the crowds and ignored emergency calls hours before the deadly crush. Among those who perished in the tragedy, 26 of them were foreigners. Five of those were Iranian. And like many of the young people who died that evening, they were students who visited South Korea to get more experience in the world and primarily more education to better themselves. Victims' families want the truth and those responsible brought to justice. A class action lawsuit is suing the government, which has often deflected responsibility and blamed the victims. It reminds some of the ferry sinking in 2014, in which more than 300 people died.
The law should be a law to punish wrong people, but the government is humiliating, insulting, and degrading the victims and the families of the deceased. In the end, I think this happened because the Sewol ferry accident was not properly resolved.
Tonight marked the 49th day since the tragedy, signifying the end of the mourning period, when the spirit of those dead to be reborn reaches Buddha and bliss. Frank Smith, Seoul.
As a presidential candidate in 2016, Donald Trump broke decades of precedent by refusing to release his tax forms to the public. However, the Democratic-controlled House Ways and Means Committee has decided to release Donald Trump's tax returns to the public. We take a look at the U.S. media's coverage of this story. The Los Angeles Times has covered the story. A House panel voted along party lines on Tuesday, 20th of December, to release former President Donald Trump's tax returns, an unprecedented move that marks the culmination of a years-long legal battle to disclose his financial records. Republicans said the move underscored Democrats' ongoing obsession with Donald Trump, warning that the release would create a dangerous weapon that could be used against other politicians, business executives, labor leaders, and even private citizens. Democrats called the move long overdue. Unlike other modern presidents, Donald Trump, who announced last month that he would run for president again in 2024, has refused to release his tax returns, which would reveal details about the source and size of his wealth, potential financial conflicts, and whether he has paid taxes in recent years. Some legal experts question whether the House Ways and Means Committee has adequate legal justification to release the information to the public. Democrats argued in court that their interest in seeing Trump's taxes was based on the need to craft legislation and that they would not simply release confidential information to the public. But now Democrats are under pressure to act, since Republicans will take over the House of Representatives in early January. After meeting privately on Tuesday for more than 4 hours, members of the House Ways and Means Committee quickly voted to release the returns without debate or speeches. "This is not about punishment. This is not about malicious," Chairman Richard Neal, a Democrat from Massachusetts, said after the vote. Richard Neal dismissed predictions that the committee's action would open the door to partisan attempts to release the tax returns of other prominent people, He said Americans have a right to see the tax returns of anyone serving in the highest office of the country. This is about the presidency, and it's not about the president, Richard Neal said, adding that he plans to introduce legislation that would require audits of future presidents, including the release of tax returns. It's unclear exactly when and how Donald Trump's tax returns, spanning the years 2015 to 2020, will be released to the public. Committee members said after the vote that it could take up to a week to redact from the documents personal information such as Social Security and bank account numbers. The committee also released a summary of Donald Trump's tax return information and a report on the IRS's mandatory presidential audit program. Democrats said they were unsure if the audit program has been active during recent presidencies, but argued it was more necessary with Donald Trump because all presidents since Richard Nixon had released their tax returns and endured public scrutiny from them. CBS News has also covered the same story and tells us more. Portions from 6 years of former President Donald Trump's tax returns will be made public by the democratically controlled House Ways and Means Committee, which voted 24-16 on Tuesday, 20th of December, to release the years of tax records Donald Trump has long tried to shield. The vote was along party lines. House Ways and Means Committee Chair Richard Neal, a Democrat from Massachusetts, on Tuesday night called for legislation that would require annual audits of a president's taxes. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi urged the House to take the legislation up quickly, which it would have to do since Republicans are set to take control of the chamber next month. On Tuesday night, the committee released two reports, one from its members and another from the Joint Committee on Taxation. The committee said in its report that it was clear that the mandatory audit program was not a priority for the IRS, and the IRS did not audit Donald Trump in the first 2 years he was in office. The former president's individual income tax returns filed in 2018, 2019, and 2020 were not selected for examination until after he left office, and only the 2016 tax return was subjected to a mandatory examination. Richard Neal said after the vote that it would take a few days to release the returns to the public, since there will have to be some redactions to protect sensitive information, such as Social Security numbers, PIN numbers, and bank account numbers. He said they will begin redacting on Tuesday night. Republican ranking member Representative Kevin Brady of Texas said the release will likely include 6 years of Donald Trump's tax returns along with the tax returns of 8 affiliated businesses and audit notes. Representative Kevin Brady said the IRS audits were not complete, so any characterization of the returns themselves, you have to acknowledge this is incomplete at this time, he added. Kevin Brady called the upcoming release a dangerous new political weapon that overturns decades of privacy protections for average taxpayers in the era of political targeting. The Wall Street Journal has also covered the same story and gives us more details. The House Ways and Means Committee voted on Tuesday, 20th of December, to release former President Donald Trump's tax returns. Representative Brendan Boyle, a Democrat from Pennsylvania, a committee member, said he expected the committee to post the full set of Donald Trump's tax returns, except for information such as Social Security numbers and bank account details. The committee's 24-16 vote, along party lines, followed a more than 4-hour closed-door meeting.